Welcome to Lynn Cullen Live, talk radio without the static. Email your questions and comments to lynncullenshow@gmail.com. And now your host, Lynn Cullen.
Hey, how you doing? January 10, 2022. Oh, boy. Hey, I'm hearing myself just talking to the producer. Some button's got to get pushed. Thank you very much. A little disconcerting there. There is so much to talk about. I don't have a clue where to start. I mean, seriously, don't. So forgive me. I'm just going to be, stream of consciousness jumping from place to place, no particular order. I wouldn't even suggest that whatever I talk about first is the most important thing, because it won't be. I just, so much. This is a problem on Mondays because of not having had an opportunity to talk about anything that happened after Thursday afternoon. That's the way that works. And the way our lives are now in this time in our nation, stories that would be like huge, huge stories just 20 years ago, 25 years ago, are now like relegated to a little spot on page 18 down in the corner under some ad. There's just too much going on. But I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. I'll just start with, again, things that are really, in the scope of things, unimportant, but I need to note. Steeler fans got really lucky. And when I'm talking about lucky, I'm talking about the Jaguars. When I heard that in order for the Steelers to have a chance, the Jaguars had to beat the Colts, I mean, I follow football enough to know that, well, that ain't going to happen. And it did. It really did. Jeez. And then, well, the New York Times sports section just giving each game a little paragraph. Summed up the Steelers' win thusly. Immediate beneficiaries of the Colts' loss, the Steelers were set to earn a wild card berth, so long as the Chargers and Raiders didn't play to a draw, of course, that didn't happen. Coach Mike Tomlin has gone 15 seasons without a losing record. That's got to be some kind of a record itself, doesn't it? Pretty impressive. And here's the part that I thought. And the shell of Ben Roethlisberger was good enough to eke out 9 wins this season. T.J. Watt tied Michael Strahan's single-season sack record and had 3 quarterback hits. Yeah, he's pretty astonishing as a player. Anyway, that's it. So Steelers... And why do we always get the late game? So the next game is what, Saturday night or Sunday night at 8:30? I'm just saying, it annoys me. So many dead people. God. Guys. The one that's all over Twitter today, because again, every day it's a different person and a different sense of communal loss. But today it's a guy that I really never paid any attention to, Bob Saget. Saget. Most people knew him as some guy, right? I never watched sitcoms, so I don't know. But yeah, he was a stand-up comedian, and apparently very, very blue, as they used to say. But that is certainly not the case with his sitcom persona, which was of a single dad and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I just wanted to say that I have never seen, I don't think, such a astonishing outpouring of grief by fellow comedians, mostly, and actors, about his unexpected death. I mean, everybody's essentially saying the same thing, that he was one of the nicest human beings they ever knew. And it just, he's one of those guys who, when he dies, it turns out that a million people thought he was their best friend. And that says something about somebody. So while I was not tuned into him, I was most aware of him as hosting America's, you know, funniest videos or something. But wow, I gotta tell you, the Twitter is just in tears, and everybody who obviously ever met the guy considered him one of the finest people they knew. So there you go. Who knew? I'm just passing that on. Must have been a wonderful, wonderful human being to get that kind of a response. Dwayne Hickman, on the other hand, might as well stay with some obits, is one of those guys that, you know, he was never that big, and I don't know, I'm sure he might have been a wonderful man, but I'm not seeing anything in Twitter about him. And you might be saying, who the hell's Dwayne Hickman? Well, this will separate the old farts from the rest. Dwayne Hickman starred in a 50s into the 60s as the lead, whose name was Dobie Gillis. I mean, this, I remember it because I was a kid. And Dobie Gillis had a friend. And this, to me, this guy was the star because he was so dopey and had such a great name. Do you remember? He was played by the actor Bob Denver. Bob Denver, who most people know from Gilligan's Island as Gilligan. But before Gilligan's Island, Bob Denver was the sort of sidekick on Dobie Gillis. And his character's name was, come on, you know it, Maynard G. Krebs. Yes, Maynard G. Krebs. Just wanted to be able to say that. So Dwayne Hickman is dead at 87. His career never was finished by his being typecast in that. No one ever saw him as anything other than this Dobie Gillis, who was unremarkable in every way. Tuesday Weld was a mainstay on that. And Warren Beatty also had a recurring role, a very young Warren Beatty. Oh, God. Okay, so that's a... but the death that just sent me and still is into a state of despair. And I, you know how sometimes you literally cannot accept a person's gone. I engage in that kind of magical thinking a lot. And hearing this man's death just hit me like a ton of bricks, even though he was old. 94. But I so loved him. As much as you can love somebody that you don't know, that you only see. And all I was, well, it's not true. What I was seeing was, of course, him, an actor playing parts. But I also knew of him as a civil rights activist. And that was not playing a part. And I watched as this man, Sidney Poitier, carried himself throughout his life in this racist nation with such dignity and with this, always this sense, this barely contained rage you could feel. It's incredible. Handsome, controlled, beautiful human being. It was the way he carried himself. And just by that alone, he showed America what a black man was, not a shuffling, tap dancing, whatever. He was this. And to this day, I thrill in disbelief at the scene from In the Heat of the Night, which I have seen a million times. Where Poitier and thinking on his name. I was just thinking it in my head. Oh, God damn it. Steiger. Rod Steiger. Gave a master class in acting. And their brilliant acting, white racist sheriff, and this, again, dignified is always what I thought of when I looked at him, as the dignity of the man. And this dignified, I think, Philadelphia cop, right, played by Poitier. But the scene was, this is a movie that came out in 1967. Well, let me tell you, 1967, Jim Crow was, believe me, still very much alive in many ways. Americans still extraordinarily racist country. Our media certainly extraordinarily racist. And in a scene where a white, rich white man slaps Sidney Poitier. And Poitier slaps him back. That slap was so astonishing. Because we'd never seen something like it before. Nothing happened. And I was watching the scene again the other day. And in terms of, it is amazing, because when the white guy slaps Poitier, there is not even a millisecond that he comes back. It is so immediate, so heartfelt, so real. And that has to be a slap. That must have, I can't imagine how it gladdened the hearts of Black people. It gladdened mine, but I just, oh my God. Just wondrous. And in 1967, that, I'm sure, if in theaters all over this country there had to have been audible gasps, I can't imagine how it played in the South. Think of how Hollywood portrayed Black people. And then think of how just by his presence alone, Poitier, destroyed the stereotype that Hollywood had building for decades and decades. I don't know. I just found him extraordinary. And to see, too, that his marriage to a white woman, Gwen Shimkus, endured everything I know about him, says incredible man, extraordinary man. Okay, I'm sorry. I have really been mourning. Last I talked to you was January 6th. I watched that night, I think it was HBO documentary on that day. And I saw stuff I had never seen before. And I was transfixed. I had never had a true appreciation of what those overwhelmed, unbelievably outnumbered Capitol Police endured. I have never had an appreciation. There was, by all accounts, an armed, bloodthirsty, raging mob breaking into the building. The cops were outnumbered. I can't even imagine. What? Did anyone ever do the numbers? The initial assault when you didn't even have the DC cops in yet? Just the Capitol cops? I mean, they were outnumbered like, I don't know, 100 to 1? It was unbelievable. And they didn't have protective gear. It was another day at the protesters were better protected than these police. And the courage it would have taken to stand there knowing there is no way that you can hold these people back. And yet when the Washington cops came in, their numbers were beneficial, but still, they were totally outnumbered. And people, they were getting, it's amazing more people weren't killed, more police weren't killed. It's amazing. And to see, there was video of one of their officers as there's like tears coming down their cheeks from tear gas and all of this other stuff, and they're bloodied. And he says to this one guy, you've got to go back. You've got to go back in. I will not lose. We will not allow the Capitol to be taken, not on our shift or whatever. And they were willing to, you could tell, they were willing to die to do something they had sworn to do. It makes the Republicans who didn't show up at any of the vigils pay their respects to the men and women who had put their lives on the line to save these Republican asses, many of whom had egged on the insurrectionists. It's so mind blowing what happens that anybody can poo-poo it or suggest that it was another day at the office is showing just how capable of, I don't even know what to call it. I don't even know what to call what these Republican office holders are willing to say and do. I cannot believe it. I'm sorry. The more I think about it, the crazier I get. And God help us. I almost died seeing it, that the Republican National Committee has said that they've narrowed down to just four cities, the places they're considering to hold their 2024 convention, where they intend to bring Donald Trump back. Yeah. And of course, Pittsburgh is on the list. And when I saw it, I thought, oh no. Oh no. Uh-uh. I cannot even begin to imagine what the 2024 Republican convention will be like. There will be violence. There is no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. And our mayor and our county council, county executive have welcomed the prospect of turning this city over to this party of white nationalist insurrectionists, Donald Trump's party. Are you kidding me? What is it? What is it about politicians that the only thing they can ever think of is, there's money in it. I'm willing to bet a $200 million to the city. Easy. You know what else there could be in it? Chaos, death, destruction. That's my bet. And to be known as the place where Trump began his triumphant return to the White House and the destruction of American democracy, that's going to be what Pittsburgh's known for? I'm sorry. Mind blowing. Make no mistake. Uh, 2024 is going to be a horror show. The Republicans are so busy right now revamping all those election laws and deciding who's going to be able to count the ballots and decide which ballots are the real ones and which are not. I heard, I can't unhear, a interview on NPR the other day about the distinct possibility of civil war. And I mean, there are those who already argue that we're in one. And yeah, maybe. I mean, it's definitely, you can see the divisions. You can see it's not hard to envision. Now, what gets people tripped up about accepting this, that the possibility of civil war in this country is very real, is that everybody thinks of, like, you know, the Civil War. Cannons, men on horseback. Of course it won't be that. Because it would be an insurgency of a minority. The Republicans and the white nationalists. That is a minority of this country. And that is one of the reasons we're where we are. Because they cannot handle the fact that they are losing power. They have been the dominant group since day one, and they see the future, and they see they will not be the dominant group. Demographers will tell them right now, it'd be about 7-8 years now, and you white people are going to be in the minority. This will not be a majority white country. This is enough, and the election, of course, of Barack Obama, to make these people go insane. So when we start looking for the beginnings of this civil war, and it is a thread that runs through our entire history, of course. Mind-blowing how it's about race all the time. But this interview I listened to was just chilling. Because some of the things I remember hearing is that civil wars do not happen in democracies. Civil wars do not happen in autocracies. Civil wars happen in countries that are uncomfortably in between the two. And guess what? That's what we are. We are not a democracy. Talked about that some last weak. We are not, never have been. And our structure, our foundational structure, allows minorities to have extraordinary power. More so than their numbers would suggest. And you already see the white supremacists and the Republican Party trying to normalize violence, like the violence on January 6th. Poo-pooing it. Spreading lies about it. I just, it's beyond belief. Okay, I see I've got callers. I'll shut up. Yeah, I will. I'll shut up. Let's let you guys in. Hang in there. I'm coming to the phones. Coming to the phones. Hello.
Hi, Lynn.
Yes.
Hello, Lynn. John from Greensburg.
Yes.
Good morning, such as it is. I think we could add that qualifier from now until...
Ever.
Well, we'll see, huh? FDR once said the Constitution is not a suicide pact, or at least that statement is attributed to him. I think he may be proven wrong.
Yeah.
Because right now, first of all, we're operating under a Constitution whose electional provisions are completely outmoded for our society.
Right.
Homogenous, evangelical, white, Christian, rural states are vastly overrepresented in the Senate. They're overrepresented in the House.
They're now overrepresented
because now the representatives are capped.
Yeah.
We've got a party that is treated as legitimate, as a legitimate partner in a democratic republic, yet they're now devoted to ending the democratic republic and turning us into something akin to modern day Hungary or Poland at best, where would there be some trappings of democracy? You have the pretense of it.
Right.
But it would essentially be authoritarian one party rule.
Correct. That is where they're heading, and with their ability to manipulate the structural changes in the already corrupted electoral process that we have, or the unfair electoral processes we have, their opportunity for pulling this off is, and they know it. It's first of all the only chance they have, right? Otherwise,
well, correct. We have to give them this. They've been long-term thinkers and planners.
They've corrupted
the federal judiciary. I would argue that the Supreme Court is currently constituted is illegitimate. We have an illegitimate Supreme Court, but there seems to be no remedy for that. None whatsoever. You know, the media would accuse, you know, they would raise the hue and cry of court packing along with the GOP. Should any move be made to expand the court? Yet somehow it wasn't court packing when they installed Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett. It wasn't even court packing when the Republican Supreme Court justices got to weigh in 5-4 on handing an election to George W. Bush, who would then appoint their successors.
That's right. Right. I know. The Supreme Court has really been tainted since that Bush v. Gore.
Once you have an authoritarian party get in and install a judiciary to their liking who will be partisan, then it becomes impossible to have a legal challenge the authoritarian government.
Yeah, you're making me think. It is so much like what has happened in Hungary, if you've been paying attention, because what did Orban do? He went after the court system. He went after courts.
So now there's no legal remedy.
Then he went after, education.
The media.
And
corporations.
And
universities.
He, well, that's right. He did. He even shut down a university.
But guess what?
Yeah.
Hungary is still shrinking in population. Guess what? Hungary is still a beggar state. Much of their GDP comes from European Union subsidies and from Hungarians working outside the nation, sending money home. Hungary is still a failed state. They're still being propped up. And that's what we would become eventually. But, you know, the other thing that astounds me, is that while they do have an intellectual wing that provides some pseudo-legalistic framework for this and cobble together justifications for oppressing people, and while they certainly have billionaire sugar daddies, they make leaders of fucking I'm sorry to swear. I've been trying to refrain from that. But I got to say it. Of fucking fools, kooks, bigots, people that if you saw them on the street, you'd walk the other way. Donald Trump looks like a clown, clown.
Yeah, I know.
Okay?
Hey,
Alex Jones.
Hey, you know, listen.
Steve Bannon.
I know. And I know you could go on for another 5 hours, but I do have another caller who's been waiting as well. So I'm going to move on, but I know you could go
on for 5 hours.
It's probably
best we do. It's best we do.
All right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. Bye. Yeah. I share your angst. Hello.
Hey, good morning, Lynn. It's Dave from Washington.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. I sent you an email. You can ignore it because I called you instead.
Okay.
My email has the wonderful little information. Tuesday Weld. Tuesday Weld was born on a Friday. You look it up.
Well, are you wondering why she got named Tuesday?
Well, I always liked that name, and I just kind of assumed she was born on a Tuesday, and I looked it up, and no, she was born on a Friday.
Is that the sum total of your contribution to the program today?
Well, that was the email.
Okay.
Then you started talking about the other stuff, and I had to call. You know, they have done their best to make voting as difficult as possible, you know, for blue people, but they have not made it impossible. So
that is true.
They don't have to win this game. This is where, and you know me and Democrats, I'm not a big fan. They're not going to go out and vote. They're going to throw their hands up and say, fuck it. They made it difficult. I'm not going to do it. You got to go vote. If everybody went out and voted, and everybody knows when they have high turnout, Democrats always win. And that's the whole point of their suppression laws is to try to.
Well, the problem is, but the problem with all this is that if we have these two warring factions, it is the Republican side that has the passionate base. They're fighting for their lives. That's the way they figure it.
Well,
and Democrats, there's not the same understanding of the importance of this and that we're fighting for our lives. And somehow our base doesn't seem to quite get it.
Exactly. That's what I've been saying. That's exactly what I say.
Because I know that's what you're saying, because I think it is such a disquieting, horrible reality that they want to do what the Republicans have done, which is escape. The Republicans escaped into a totally different reality, right? Where up is down, black is white. And we don't have the capacity to do that.
Right.
So we just turn away. Yeah, that's right.
That is why I, you know, politically support them and agree with them. And I've told you this 100 million times. So I refuse to join the damn party. They won't get off their asses. None of the roadblocks that they put up, there's only one. And that's why they threw that last one in. If all else fails, they can just arbitrarily throw out the results of a state election and assign whatever electors they want. That was
their
fault.
Well, the reality now in some places, right?
It is, yeah. We don't like these results. All the tactics that they put in place to repress the vote, they didn't work. So you know what? We're just going to throw them out and declare our own winner. That you can't do much about. But People, you got to go out and vote. And if they make it difficult, they're taking away voting boxes and not allowing you to go out on Sundays. Well, then don't go out on Sundays. They won't let you mail it in. Then go to the damn polls. It is not impossible. But you're going to lose everything if you don't do it.
Right. Hey, thank you.
You're welcome. Talk to you later, Lynn.
Bye. Bye. There's an organization that tracks state of democracies and governments around the world. This is something else I learned in the, I think that interview. The United States has been at the top of, they assign a number, the highest being 10 plus or, and the lowest being 10 minus. You know, the worst, like North Korea would be on the 10 minus in terms of freedom and everything. And the United States used to be considered the longest running democracy. We're not anymore. They took us down. We dropped. Our numbers dropped. And it makes you, I woke up, this is why I don't sleep. I woke up thinking that in our lifetime, democracy just seemed like, yeah, that's what we got. And then we got, and look at us. We're rich, we're big, we're bad. Most of us are relatively comfortable. Yeehaw! Democracy is a flash in the pan. Other than Greece, did it even really, I mean, other than, yeah, ancient Greece, it wasn't resurrected again until this experiment called the United States of America. That's why a young nation like the United States would be considered the oldest democracy and the longest running democracy in the world. And now you're seeing, even though we could not have imagined it because we were born into it, as our parents and grandparents might have been, that we thought this was what is. Well, guess what? No, not necessarily. And if the Republican Party has its way, we will cease to be a democracy. We'll be that something in between, but definitely leaning toward autocracy or rule of just one party who's fixed the game. Remember, one of the things I remember about Donald Trump as we got to know him was that I remember saying, you know, every lie that comes out of his mouth that he says, you know, like the Democrats are, it's always a lie. But if you instead say, change it to the Republicans are, then it's the truth. So he projected all the time. Everything before the last election that he lost, months and months before, he was saying it's going to be rigged. They're going to rig it. Well, that was a lie. But if you switch, and if he were saying, we're going to rig it, that would be the truth. Every nasty thing he ever said about somebody was a projection of his own repulsive id. And was about him. Just so you know, a leading scholar in Canada whose specialization is violent conflict has been vociferous in attempting to get the attention of the Canadian government because he says Canada needs to be prepared because this big nation to their southern border is about to explode. And Canada needs to figure out what are we going to do to safeguard our nation, to deal with the stream of possible refugees desperate to get out of this white supremacist fascist America. Somebody else who spent an entire career studying civil wars all over the world said this: I've seen how civil wars start, and I know the signs, and I can see those signs emerging here at a surprisingly fast rate. And so you have Republicans now trying to normalize things about, you know, violence being necessary. And you see the polls that an incredible percentage of Republicans say that, yes, violence may be necessary. Mm-hmm. So if it's not like, you know, Antietam and Gettysburg, what would the Civil War look like? Well, it would look more, it'd be more like terroristic, guerrilla-ish warfare. It would be little cells all over the place. It'd be bombings and acts of terror in an attempt to destabilize the nation to the point where people are willing to accept an autocracy if they can just get back to being able to live their lives and not be in such fear. And it's a deal that human beings make. The other thing that they say to look out for is the provocation. That what the right really wants to do is provoke our side to do something, perhaps violent as well. But they tried to, I mean, actually tried to blame January 6th on us. Unbelievable. But if they can get us to do something out of character, it would allow them to underscore to their base what a danger we are. And, you know, we know how these things work. It doesn't require, most of us would not be engaged. It requires, you know, passionate folks on both sides. Now, one thing that made me feel like maybe we'd be okay is that the corporations might realize that this is not good for business. And so they'd weigh in on the Democratic side. And that seemed to be what happened immediately after January 6th, correct? A number of corporations said that they would no longer give any money to any Republicans who voted or acted in any way to discredit the 2020 election. Even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce did that. At the time, the head of the Chamber of Commerce says there are some members in Congress who, by their actions, will have forfeited the support of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And they weren't alone. We kept hearing from this corporation and that corporate, okay, we're done. We ain't funding these folks anymore. Guess what? And here's where media fail us. 2 months after the Chamber of Commerce said that, they started giving money the aiders and abettors of the insurrection. And even put out a explanation. And here's the explanation, guys. We do not believe it is appropriate to judge members of Congress solely based on their votes on the electoral certification. 2 months later, they did a total 180. And so the money is flowing, millions of dollars from these lobbying groups and from corporate PACs to what is called the Sedition Caucus. Yeah. So if you think we're going to get saved by the corporations, I am not so sure. Here are some, if you want to know, I don't have all the names, that are now giving money to seditionists: Boeing, Pfizer, GM, Ford, AT&T, UPS. On the other hand, there are companies that have kept their word and have maintained their, you know, pledge not to donate. And I wish I could give you a list, that list, but I don't. Microsoft is one. They have held firm. And Hewlett-Packard as well. Those are the only two I know. Now, one of the people in the Sedition Caucus is, of course, the senator from my home state of Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, who is generally considered to be the Senate's biggest purveyor of absolute falsehoods. He's like Trump. Every time he opens his mouth, he's lying. You know, how do you know when Ron Johnson's lying? If his lips are moving. And so it turns out that when he was first elected and pledged that he would only serve two terms, that was a lie too, because he has announced he is running for his third term. Everything this guy says is a lie. He's still saying that January 6th was Antifa and Democrats posing as Trump supporters, trying to make them look bad. He is still out there saying he'll never get vaccinated and that the vaccine is dangerous. Yeah. Boy, oh boy. He's running again. Allison says, I know what you speak of when you say you love Sidney Poitier. I did too. And I'm not just throwing the word love around loosely. When I would see him in one of his movies, he just warmed my heart. You knew he was truly a good man. He spoke so eloquently after coming to the United States with no formal education. In the past several years, I would see him growing older and would think, someday we're going to lose this wonderful person. But when I saw that he passed away, my heart just sunk. Hard to explain for a person you've never met. Yeah, but such a sad feeling of loss. One thing I will have memories of is my daughter, when she was young, discovering the movie To Sir With Love. I just rewatched that a few weeks ago. Wow. We watched it so many times together, and I will always remember her jumping on top of the coffee table with her hairbrush microphone and singing the song at the end of the movie. She's in her 30s now, and she called me to see if I knew that Sir had passed away. Yeah. He was something. It was something. I always thought the one where he befriended the blind girl. What was that called? Oh, God. There's not a, I mean, the one he made with also with Tony Curtis, where there are both escapees, the defiant ones. And then A Raisin in the Sun, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And you know what? See, so many of these were constricted. If you look at them now, you see that they still refuse to allow a true portrayal of him. There were still these, and it was his dignity, his bearing, his self-confident authority, his style that would just blow any movie he was in out of the water. A Patch of Blue. He was a huge cultural figure. He changed things. Oh, I don't know. Here's a sentence that I absolutely understood. If the Marvel cinematic universe had existed in the 60s, Poitier might have made a perfect Hulk, because like that fictional hero, his superpower was to stay angry even at his most relatable. He is understandably being celebrated as an icon of cinematic representation and reassurance, but we ignore at our peril the fact that those values coexisted with rage that feels as palpable and galvanizing today as it did half a century ago. And it's that bare, that right under the surface of his glorious black skin, that sense of rage that I found so compelling. I'm going to give you two factoids to end the program. Don't ask me why. Just because. Oh, I also want to give you a heads up that on Thursday, I'm going to do what I so rarely do. I'm going to have a guest, an author, Jessica Nordell. And I am almost finished with her book. It's everything we've been talking about when we're talking about race. And her book is called The End of Bias, which, of course, ain't gonna happen. But a subheading of the title is The Science and Practice of Overcoming Unconscious Bias. So she lays out in this book where bias comes from, and it's as human can be. And then what works and what doesn't in overcoming it. And it's pretty daunting. A lot of the efforts at diversity and diversity training, it doesn't work. Doesn't work at all. In fact, some of it's counterproductive. She's actually gone in and studied all of this stuff. It's brilliant. She's a brilliant science journalist. And I happened to bump into her mom in Green Bay, of all places, when I was there. But the book is amazing. It really is. So she'll be on Thursday. Okay, here's some factoids for you. Adults spend as much as 47% of their waking lives letting their minds wander. Jeez, do you think? That's almost half of the time we're awake, we're not focused at all. Okay, I guess that's what that would mean, yeah. Our minds are wandering. I don't know how they calibrate something like that, but hey, man, this came out of Harvard, so I guess it must be true. And then this little factoid, which I guess I didn't really know, but sort of did, because I get, you know, I pull out a sweater I love in the winter, and it's got a hole in it where some damn moth has eaten it. And often it doesn't, but it has that like sort of white, spidery thing on it that is what? That's where the larvae are. Well, it turns out, and I don't think I knew that, it's not the moth that eats the clothes. It's the larvae. Why didn't I know that? But where do the larvae come from? They come from the moth. So I guess they're all fair game if you're into like trying to make war on them. It is not the adult moth that eats clothing. It's the tiny little caterpillars that become the moths that feast on clothing, particularly being partial to wool and cashmere. Tell me about it. I had this glorious wool area rug. Unbeknownst to me, they were eating it year after year. I didn't even know until I picked it up one day a little bit, and huge chunks of it came falling out. They ate this whole 8x10 rug. Little teeny weeny caterpillars. Anyway, I just wanted you to know that fact. It weren't the moths. Okay? All right, that's it for me. I'm done. I am more than done. I am just so not in a great place, guys. But I am going to persevere because what choice do I have? And that goes for you, too. All right. Stay warm. Keep your heads down. Wear a mask. Excuse me. Didn't mean to scream at you. And I'll see you tomorrow. Susan should be joining us. Toodle-oo.
Lynn Cullen Live, Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. and archived at pghcitypaper.com. The opinions expressed on Lynn Cullen Live are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of Pittsburgh City Paper or its advertisers.